In world news, a judge in Egypt has sentenced three Al Jazeera English journalists to prison for doing their jobs.
Post-revolution Egypt, similar to pre-revolution Egypt. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In a 9-0 ruling, the justices say cops can't search your cell phones without a warrant.
The court is setting a marker that says this information is too precious to be handed away to the government willy-nilly. They can do way too much damage with it.
Also, a book reviewer describes how she came to love true crime.
The very important vector of introduction to true crime for young women is when you're babysitting and you look for the dirty books and the sugary snacks.
There's so much more after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This was the sound in the courtroom as three Al Jazeera journalists were dragged back to their cells following convictions this week in Cairo on charges of conspiring to endanger the Egyptian government. With the verdict, 7 years for two defendants, 10 years for a third, the hope and inspiration of Tahrir Square clouded over into distant memory. Following a show trial filled with conspiracy theories and a bizarre array of supposed evidence, the journalists became victims of a political environment that can twist basic news reporting into sedition. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has said he will not intervene. That news did not sit well either in international capitals or in the media. Denunciation of the verdict was angry and immediate.
The three men convicted of committing journalism now to spend years in an Egyptian prison. It is an unthinkable disaster.
In world news, a judge in Egypt has sentenced three Al Jazeera English journalists to prison for doing their jobs.
Three journalists were held in cages throughout the trial, and the evidence presented against them was frankly laughable, including a BBC podcast, a news report made while none of the accused were in Egypt, and a video by the Australian singer Gotye.
Among the other allegedly damning exhibits was one of the defendant's family's vacation photos and a souvenir bullet from a protest, which is why suspicion ran high that the trial was not about the defendants, but their employer. Qatar-based Al Jazeera was seen by the military regime and others as supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood-centered government el-Sisi deposed. Apart from the jailing of the journalists, the most immediate effect of the verdict was to negate claims by the el-Sisi government of its dedication to democracy and pluralism. As Guardian columnist Jess Hill observed, no Al Jazeera report could have damaged Egypt's reputation as much as this sentence. On CNN, Fareed Zakaria had possibly the most chilling take. If Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring allowed Egyptians to look forward, the naked suppression of a free press transports us hauntingly back.
The old Egypt is back. That is the deep state, the state of Mubarak and Nasser, the state that ruled for 40 or 50 years in a kind of uninterrupted military dictatorship, is back.
And because geopolitics are complex, all the world can do is flick on Al Jazeera and watch.
Since the violent extremist group ISIS began taking control of large parts of Iraq, a media narrative explaining its stunning rise has gathered force. It goes something like this. In the absence of a tyrant or occupying force, sectarian hatred has emerged once again and is tearing the country apart.
The destruction of Iraq has returned it to the ancient rivalries between Shia, Sunni, and Kurd.
They injected once again chaos into this system, and all of the old problems, all of those sectarian tensions rose to the surface.
What we have to do is look at where we are today, and where we are today is based on centuries of a sectarian conflict just coming to roost once again.
But is sectarianism the best prism through which to understand the unfolding disaster in Iraq? In a word, no, says Ibrahim al-Marashi, professor of history at California State San Marcos, who we reached in Istanbul.
These are not kind of your ancient ethnic hatred that was used to explain away the conflict in, let's say, Yugoslavia or Rwanda. Shias and Sunnis have inhabited what is today's Iraq for centuries without the events of communal violence that we see today. So in other words, you can't just look at the last couple of years and say it's always been this way. The word sectarian suggests that sects are cohesive political units. But even among groups like ISIS, they, as a Sunni group, are more than willing to kill other Sunnis who get in their way. It would be misleading to call it sectarian. I would call it simply a power play.
Okay, so let's say it is a power play. Isn't the power play seemingly always between Sunnis and Shia?
No. If you looked at politics from the 40s all the way to the 70s, what drove conflict back then was a clash of ideologies. It was communists versus pro-Western Republicans. In Lebanon, for example, if you look at the Lebanese Civil War, you would say that's a classical example of sect, Maronites versus Sunni Muslims. But you had Christians fighting alongside Muslims because those Christians believed in communism, and the government in Beirut was a pro-Western anti-communist government. Look at Iraq in the present. If it was sectarianism then driving the conflict, you would assume all the Shia parties, as well as all the Sunni parties, could unite on the sectarian platform. But that hasn't happened. It invalidates the notion that sectarianism in and of itself is driving the conflict.
So what is, and why so consistently, across the region?
What appears to be a sectarian conflict is the nature of violent political conflict around the world, whether we're talking about Latin America or Africa. It just so happens in the Middle East, the contest to the largest of the state, whether it's oil revenues, whether it's the patronage networks that the state provides, happens to fall along sectarian lines.
Then it seems that one part of the media narrative would also be true, which is that if Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki were able to, or if he had, put in a more power-sharing government, then maybe ISIS couldn't find a safe haven.
But you have to understand it from Maliki's perspective. There was a genuine fear in the Iraqi state that the Ba'athists would come back to power. And the Ba'athists happened to be Arab Sunnis. So what would seem like anti-Sunni muzzling, he's not going to do this without reaping some political awards. And we saw that in the recent elections. He definitely won a huge part of the popular vote, and his party was the largest victor in the last parliamentary election.
Many historians, notably David Fromkin in his 1989 magisterial bestseller, The Peace to End All Peace, said that the groundwork for today was laid in 1916 by France and Britain with Russia's assent in the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement that divided the Middle East in spheres of influence. And then later in 1920, the borders were redrawn. Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, they didn't exist prior to World War I. Many of these states seemed to be intended to divide one group from another or impose the rule of minorities over majorities.
Sykes-Picot did create states that served colonial interests rather than it reflecting tribal and ethnic realities on the ground. Nevertheless, states like Syria and Iraq do correspond to geographical regions that have been closely integrated over a long historical period of time. So it's not so much about the drawing of the borders, but the colonial practices of governance that set up these states to be inherently unstable, where minorities would perpetuate the rule. Iraq's first king was not from Iraq. He was also an Arab Sunni ruling over a new state that was predominantly Kurdish by ethnicity and Shia by sect. That starts Iraq on a political trajectory that will eventually lead to the rise of Saddam Hussein and the chaos we see now.
What perception propagated in the media that is wrong is likely to lead to wrong policy?
I would say, number one, the media narrative, and I see this reflected in policy circles, that this is a sectarian conflict that has been raging on since time immemorial, and that the conflict is simply a conflict driven by differences in religious practice. That's the first mistake, because you're developing policy treating Iraq as three different ethnic cantons, if you will.
The Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds.
Which also then leads to kind of renewed calls saying, okay, maybe Iraq should be partitioned along those lines. And again, I would say that's a mistaken policy because Iraq is not neatly divided among those three communities. Such a partition would be an even more bloodier process than we're seeing today. And number two, the second media narrative is if Maliki were to resign, all of Iraq's problems would be solved. Sure, you can call for Maliki to resign, but then again, you have a large segment of Iraq's population that was behind him.
What do you think of David Fromkin's view, then, the author of The Peace to End All Peace? He likened the situation in the Middle East to that of Europe in the 5th century after the collapse of the Roman Empire. He wrote, quote, "It took Europe a millennium and a half to resolve its post-Roman crisis of social and political identity and nearly 1,000 years to settle on the nation-state form of political organization and 500 more years to determine which nations were entitled to be states. The continuing crisis in the Middle East in our time may prove to be nowhere near so long-lasting, but the issue is the same, how diverse peoples are to regroup to create new political identities for themselves after the collapse of an age-old imperial order to which they'd grown accustomed."
Fromkin has a point in that it was a peace that ended all peace in the Middle East, but we have to give agency to various Arab leaders who have also put the Middle East in the situation that it is today. The borders were kind of a recipe for a toxic stew, but the cooks at the end of the day were still Middle Eastern leaders who allowed this to happen.
Ibrahim, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ibrahim Al-Marashi is a professor of history at California State San Marcos, and we spoke to him from Istanbul.
Coming up, more about some persistent media narratives that need some probing, like, are we really more polarized?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. Find out how LegalZoom can help you start and protect your business through incorporation, LLCs, nonprofits, trademarks, and more. LegalZoom has helped start over 1 million businesses and received an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. More information at LegalZoom.com. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this month, the Pew Research Center published a study titled Political Polarization in the American Public. It was like the polar ice caps had suddenly melted.
A huge new Pew Research Center study of 10,000 American adults finds us more divided than ever, with personal and political polarization at a 20-year high.
The Pew Research Center finds Americans are deeply divided, which we know, but common ground is quickly disappearing.
Is America getting more divided? Pew reports the answer is yes.
The Pew Center's president, Alan Murray, wrote in the Wall Street Journal that we're living in the divided states of America and that, quote, the study should put to rest any notion that polarization is solely a Washington phenomenon. But Stanford University political scientist Morris Fiorina dug into Pew's data and says that, in fact, that's not what it shows.
Polarization in common parlance means people moving toward the extremes. That's really not what's happening and not what the Pew report showed. What it reflects really is the sorting out of the two political parties in the United States, that people are becoming more consistent in their views. At one point, for example, the Democratic Party had both the most serious opposition to civil rights and the greatest support for civil rights. This held for other policies as well. Now, the Republicans have gotten rid of their liberal wing. The Democrats have gotten rid of their conservative wing.
The profile of a member of the party is better defined than it used to be, say, back in the 80s when you had Scoop Jackson Democrats and Rockefeller Republicans?
Exactly. Today, the simple fact is party and ideology are lined up better. They used to cross-cut much more than they do now. Certainly, there is more partisan conflict, and certainly there is a greater difference between the parties. But the people who are not closely aligned with either party, the independents, the moderates, the inconsistents, they're still just as large a group. And I think that's what really was missed by the discussion of the Pew report, is that the inconsistents are still the largest part of the population.
So the inconsistents are still a plurality of the population? Has it gone up or down at all since 1994?
The inconsistents have definitely declined in number. But you have to dig deep into how the index in the Pew study is constructed, that there are 10 policy questions, and they give people dichotomous choices, things like, do you favor military strength or diplomacy?
Let's list a few more of those. Do you think blacks are responsible for their own condition, or is it racial discrimination? Do you think homosexuality should be discouraged or not?
And you have to choose one side or the other, and most people will oblige and do that. But just because you say, for example, I favor military strength over diplomacy, doesn't mean it's a 100-to-nothing choice. It may be sort of 60-40. And so what they're pointing out is that somebody who is sort of on one side, slightly, for example, on military strength, probably now tends also to be slightly on that same side on these other items. It really doesn't say how far toward the other side they've gone. The data show increases in consistency, not extremity. Now, the middle, I like to say the middle is a muddle, because, in fact, you could have people who are very extreme in their positions, but inconsistent, a stereotypical right-wing populist who wants, for example, to deport all illegal aliens and cut off services to the poor and so forth, but at the same time wants to hammer big business and tax them and so forth. Now, that person will not have moderate positions, but because they're inconsistent, they end up in the center of the Pew distributions, which is really mixed, not center.
Okay, but aren't we more extreme? I mean, in the run-up to the 2012 campaign, most of the Republican candidates either declared that they didn't believe in evolution or at the very least supported the allotting of equal time to creationism in the classroom. And another Pew study said that Republicans are less inclined than they were in 2009 to say that humans have evolved.
If you had asked that same question 30 years ago, there would have been a lot of Democrats who didn't believe in evolution because there were a lot of Southern evangelicals who were in the Democratic Party in that era. I actually have these tables in some of my lectures, and I shock my students about the number of people who don't believe in evolution. It really hasn't changed in the United States in 30 years, but it no longer cross-cuts the parties. It's now all in the Republican Party. That a majority of the American people, by the way, don't believe in Darwin.
If this study doesn't show polarization, if it merely shows sorting into political parties, that's not nothing, right?
I would strongly object to the word merely. In fact, it is highly significant that what we now have is two ideological parties, and even when they don't really disagree on substance, they simply fight each other to try to get issues for the next election. So, I think it has extremely negative influences on our politics.
There were also some numbers related to how much one party mistrusts the other to basically run the country.
When the parties were more heterogeneous, you sort of knew there were people basically like you in the other party. Whereas today, if you're a Democrat or a Republican, you look at the other party and you say, these people really are different in so many ways. So it's logical to think you would mistrust the other party more than you used to, simply because they are more different from you now than they used to be. But I'm just saying the critical distinction between sorting and polarization is that polarization implies the middle is going away, that there is no center. There's just two competing sides. Sorting says that you could have two very well-sorted parties and still have a very large unsorted middle, which is what the current state of play is in American public opinion.
I'm going to invoke Stephen Colbert's great introduction to the English language truthiness here. Is there a sense among the media and among the people that, you know, the country is more polarized? It just feels that way. The extreme voices are louder, and there's a lot more of them.
Perception's important, and study after study shows, in fact, that people think the country is more polarized than it actually is because of all the shout shows on TV and all of the blogs, etc. But if you actually look at the audiences for these shows, you look at the audiences for the blogs, the visitors, they are tiny. The majority of the American public still feels that we ought to be able to work out our differences and come to a reasonable middle ground. And they'd like to see the government do that. The problem is the public face of politics in America is driven by a tiny, unrepresentative, extreme slice of the population. It does give a perception that is damaging.
Looking at the data, though, things are a little bit worse, right? 2 or 3%?
Well, put it this way. If you look at the distribution of ideology in the United States as a whole, it has simply not changed since 72. If you look at the distribution of partisanship, it has simply not changed since 84. Gallup registered the highest proportion of independents in history in 2013. If you look at issues, in fact, people are lumping up in the center as much as ever. So if you look at the American population as a whole, no, I think the answer is there is simply no evidence of polarization. But again, if you look at party sorting, if you look at how the relationship between ideology and party has changed, then there is a great deal of what I call party polarization. But the problem is we shouldn't mistake that for polarization of the population as a whole.
You've really made me feel better.
I hope so. I think the American population deserves to feel better. But I think the political order is not serving them very well.
Thank you very much, Mo.
You're very welcome, Brooke.
Morris Fiorina is a professor of political science at Stanford University and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution.
And now for some more conventional wisdom, debunked. Everyone knows that student debt is at historic highs and an unscalable obstacle for a whole generation of young people trying to enter the economy.
Saving for college is very, very important. We've got a student loan crisis in America. It's larger than credit card debt now.
Well, if you are buried in student loan debt, you're not alone. 40 million Americans have outstanding loans. That's more than the entire population of most countries.
The amount of debt that is crushing students
so many,
is just unbelievable.
But then on Tuesday, David Leonhardt of the New York Times reported on a just-released Brookings Institution study on education debt. It was headlined, "The Reality of Student Debt is Different from the Clichés," an assertion so out of sync with conventional wisdom that other writers instantly produced impassioned attacks on Leonhardt and Brookings for jumping to conclusions based on shoddy research. The New York Times itself seemed a little conflicted on the issue. The weekend before Leonhardt's article, its Sunday magazine cover story titled, "It's Official, the Boomerang Kids Won't Leave," detailed the hardship faced by many postgraduate millennials. Reporter Adam Davidson wrote that, quote, "One in five people in their 20s and early 30s is currently living with his or her parents." That's a stat that certainly tracks with the sense that student debt is at an all-time high. But that Brookings study says it ain't so. What if what we all know for sure and what the media tell us is wrong? What if criticism of that study hinges on questions easily answered by statistical norms? In a follow-up piece in Wednesday's Times, Leonhardt addressed those very questions. Dave, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So can we begin with the most basic question? Did you screw up here a lot, a little bit, not at all?
Not at all.
Tell me.
We have had a rise in student debt over the last couple decades, but we have also had a rise in income over the last couple decades. And so the amount that the typical person with student debt needs to pay has remained relatively similar over that time. And yet, because the economy has been so disappointing, student debt has become an easy thing to blame. And that's why you often see in the media anecdotes of someone who has $50,000 or $75,000 or $100,000 in debt. And when you go look at the numbers, those people are quite rare, and none of the numbers disagree about that. And I think the problem here is that those of us in the media are more likely to know people who go to elite colleges. And so you're more likely to know a couple people who maybe majored in something that has left it hard for them to get a job in, and maybe they did take out tons of debt. And so we exaggerate how common the problem is.
Are you talking about the stereotypical privileged kid with the arts history degree and nothing much to show for it?
As a colleague of mine joked, there are some of those people, and probably every one of them has been profiled in the media over the last few years. The much bigger problem, it's not the poet with $90,000 in debt. It's the kid with $15,000 in debt who leaves college without a degree. That is a much more common situation. One of the things that I am arguing is that we should pay more attention to the larger problem.
Okay, fair enough. But you were writing about this study, and the study was based on households with people between the ages of 20 and 40. But the authors did not include households where a recent graduate is back in his or her old bedroom because he or she has a degree and debt and is unemployed or underemployed.
It's because there has not been a huge increase in the number of people doing that. I mean, it is true that the number of kids who are living at home with their parents seems to have risen, but it also fell before that. We don't remember that the economy was also quite weak in the early 90s, and a lot of people did it back then. So it's just not that much higher than it was
when it previously spiked, but against historical averages, isn't it at something close to a historic high?
Well, if it was 7% in 1992 and 8% right now, I'd be wary of saying that it's a historic high. Kevin Carey of the New America Foundation did this great thing. He went and he tracked down all the unemployed and underemployed college graduates that the media had written about during the early 80s and the early 90s and the early 2000s recessions. And he found where they were now. And they were overwhelmingly doing quite well. And so you could imagine back in the early 80s or the early 90s that you and I would be having this conversation and one of us would be saying, boy, I know so many young college graduates right now who are just having such a hard time. I can't imagine that they won't have a really, really hard time ever recovering from that in any meaningful way. But that's why we really do want to dig into the data and not put too much weight on anecdotes.
You pointed out from the Brookings study that the percentage of students graduating with more than $50,000 in debt was not vastly larger than it had been historically adjusted for inflation. If a lot of young people have $48,000 in debt or $43,000, they don't make the $50,000 threshold, but that's still a pretty crippling burden for people who are working at Starbucks. Did that get misrepresented?
No, I think the thing that gets misrepresented is someone who just listened to the kind of numbers you walked through or read a typical story in much of the media about this would imagine, wow, $45,000 in debt is a really common amount of debt. And it's just not. If you look at households between ages 20 and 40 that have at least $30,000 in debt, we're talking about 6% of all households. Not nobody, but the discussions that you see in the media projects those things as the norm, and they're not the norm.
I want to get back to the way you wrote your original piece. Make an assertion which is quite contrarian and argues that we're kind of missing the real story. But then, in a clarification in the form of a Q&A piece in Wednesday's Times, you doubled back with a kind of asterisk, which was to note that in 2010, 36% of households with people between the ages of 20 and 40 had education debt versus only 14% in 1989. And you doubled back to acknowledge that the overall debt load is going up. If you had to do it all over again, Dave, would you rewrite this story so that you didn't have to go two steps forward and one step back?
No. I think good reporting is including nuance, rather than deciding that you're going to make an argument and ignore any evidence that points the other way. The idea that we've exaggerated elite student debt and undercovered the kind of student debt that affects most kids isn't contrarian at all among economists. It's sort of conventional wisdom. Now, having said that, in the course of arguing that I think we've missed a substantial part of the story, we being the media as a whole, I don't want to go so far as to pretend there aren't issues with student debt. I think that's being less honest with readers. Part of it really is I've spent so long listening to people whose job it is to study these issues talk to me about how badly they think the media is covering the story.
Dave, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
David Leonhardt is the editor of The Upshot at the New York Times. This week, the Supreme Court ruled on two media technology cases, one that may save the bacon of big broadcast and cable, the other that strikes a blow for digital privacy. In a unanimous decision, the court ruled that in most circumstances, police officers will not be able to search an arrested citizen's cell phone without first obtaining a warrant. Writing on behalf of the court, Chief Justice John Roberts observed that cell phones are, quote, such a pervasive and insistent part of daily life that the proverbial visitor from Mars might conclude they were an important feature of human anatomy. On the same day, the court ruled that startup Aereo, despite an ingenious technological loophole, had violated copyrights by harvesting local broadcast signals and streaming them to subscribers. Dahlia Lithwick has the court beat at Slate and joins us once again. Hello, Dahlia.
Hi there, Bob.
Let's start with the Aereo case. Now, cable TV uses a big whopping antenna and harvests local broadcast signals and sends them along to its subscribers, but also pays a whopping fee to the stations for that privilege. Aereo was doing the same thing, more or less, and paying nobody a dime, correct?
That's exactly right. And in fact, some of these laws come about because, you know, cable used to steal broadcasts. Aereo really argued that, look, what we're doing is analogous to just renting out those rabbit ears that you can pop on the top of your TV. We're not broadcasting. We're not doing anything that violates copyright.
And the reason that Aereo was even able to proffer that argument is because their antenna was not the big, gigantic one scooping in everything, but many, 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 many tiny little dime-sized antennas that each subscriber would use individually as he or she was streaming local content. So in a very real way, it was one antenna to one user, but ultimately just to get around the copyright laws. There are future implications from this case. The most immediate is that it probably spells the end for Aereo unless they can actually sell their technology and their patents to cable companies.
That's right. And when you look at how the criticism of this decision breaks down, there's an awful lot of feeling that this is a horrible, horrible decision, not just in terms of absolutely squelching future innovation and interesting new technology and the possibility of moving into the cloud computing space, but really that, oh my God, the broadcast networks are hemorrhaging viewers. Now they have viewers who want to pay for their content. There was a way that the networks could have really capitalized on the fact that people are kind of interested in their sports program. They're kind of interested in some of their shows. Why would you possibly shut down a mechanism to give them those shows?
Now, about a year ago, we spoke to the founder of Aereo, who who made his case, I don't think all that persuasively, but it sounded like this.
What about a library? A library buys books without any permission and is allowed to rent them out to anybody as a public service, and build ancillary businesses supplying video services, all kinds of different things.
One of the really interesting things in this case is it's a kind of war of bad analogies. So Justice Breyer is talking about, you know, no, this is exactly like cable. Justice Scalia is talking about how it's like making photocopies with a library card. Both sides are sort of struggling to ram this into the existing copyright doctrine. The court is really, really grappling not just with what Aereo is doing, but the implications going forward for cloud computing, for DVRs, and for things that they don't even begin to understand. But Justice Breyer hastens to say, this case has no future implications for any of that good stuff, all that good innovation. We don't want to quell any of that. But meanwhile, they're talking about photocopying library cards and Betamaxes.
Now, from the almost ridiculous to the sort of sublime, a rare unanimous decision by a very polarized court on the subject of cell phone privacy. Tell me the cases that led to this decision, please.
This actually comes up as two cases, one that comes up out of California, one that comes up out of Massachusetts. In one case, we're talking about a case called Riley. The other is a case called Worry. In both cases, these people are stopped for routine, kind of trivial arrests, and a search of their cell phones shows that they are involved in much, much worse crimes. The question is that kind of search permissible? And 9-0 in an opinion written by the Chief Justice? Absolutely not. This is not like searching your glove box. It's not like shaking you by the heels and seeing what comes out of your pockets. This is like searching your diary. This is like searching your desk drawers. The court could not be clearer. And I think in a deep way, understanding of the fact that all the things that the framers sought to protect with the Fourth Amendment, our private papers, our diaries, our deepest, most intimate thoughts, all of that has migrated onto our phones, and allowing the police to just search it, search the content of it, is absolutely got to be forbidden by the Fourth Amendment, whether or not the framers knew that cell phones were coming.
Now, not unpredictably, the cops were kind of bummed. The smartphone was just a fabulous law enforcement tool for them, and they've, I guess, lost that, at least absent a warrant, forever.
Well, the cops have a few escape routes here, and Roberts is clear about this. If there is an exigent circumstance, if there is some clear sign that they are in danger absent grabbing the phone, they're always going to be able to get that. Roberts says, hey, technology works both ways. You can get a warrant in 40 seconds on your iPad.
So on the horizon, a bunch of cases linked to the Snowden revelations about NSA snooping. Does this case give us any reason to think that the court is going to put the reins on security agency overreach?
It certainly feels to me like some of the language in here is a little bit foreshadowing that the justices have a problem with the collection, not just of your metadata, which is what comes up in some of these NSA cases, but your data altogether. And so I don't want to read too much into these cases. It is clear that the lower courts are just struggling with them now. But I would say that one thing you can tell if you read Roberts in its entirety, he is saying that the government can make so much trouble for you by aggregating your material and looking at it en masse. This is really so dangerous and so violative of what the framers were terrified of with these general warrants. And so it does look like, in some sense, the court, again, 9-0, is setting a marker that says this information is too precious to be handed away to the government willy-nilly. They can do way too much damage with it.
Dahlia, as always, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick covers legal affairs for Slate.com.
Coming up, coverage of sin, vice, and crime. Why they're good and good for you.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
There are 8 million stories in the Naked City. This has been one of them.
The New York Times has just inaugurated its Sin and Vice beat in its Metro section. City editor Dean Chang told the New York Observer that he didn't come up with the beat as an excuse to run titillating stories in the New York Times. The idea was to cover things and places that wouldn't naturally have a voice in the Metro section. But what if the people doing things in those places prefer to be voiceless? That's the challenge facing newly minted Sin and Vice reporter Mosi Secret, an award-winning investigative reporter who's been covering the courts and social services for the paper for the last few years. Mosi, welcome to On the Media. And how'd you get that name?
Thank you. Secret's just been a family name for a long time. I just got lucky in the surname lottery.
So why did the gray lady go with Sin? Is she just throwing her hat into the clickbaiting ring?
People would like to think that the newspaper conceived this beat as a way to attract more readers, but it really was more organic than that. It will be a chance to get into places and find characters. In the end, even if this is behavior that people find undesirable, there will be a human element in there that people can connect with. We should kind of know what other people are like. And we want there to be some greater idea about what this says about New York. New York is a lot more expensive than it used to be. So the people who were kind of driving the scenes, doing weird and illicit stuff, they can't really afford to live here anymore. So the first story, what we saw is that the people who are doing this stuff are actually very affluent. And I suspect I will see more of that.
So then let's talk about your first story, which just came out a few weeks ago. It's basically about a brothel called the Bliss Bistro.
I was introduced to the place by a lawyer who I know who represents the guy who runs the brothel. My first visit there, I was in and out of the place. I didn't want like a woman to approach me and ask me if I wanted to do anything. I just wanted to kind of like see the place and get out of there. I saw women in barely any clothes and men kind of happy in that kind of drunk way.
They're mingling at a bar.
Yeah. It had kind of like a griminess to it. The furniture was very old. The place was dingy.
And yet the clientele seemed pretty well-heeled to you.
Right. These businessmen, professional men for the most part, are in this pretty grimy place, which you would expect them not to be. The challenge was, what do you say to these people? I'm a reporter with the Times. I want you to tell me why you're here and what you're doing.
Have you started to work out a strategy?
I'm still figuring it out. I can say that I have been less successful since that story. Right now, I'm just trying to develop trust, let them know that I'm going to protect them, that they don't have to worry about getting in trouble because of anything that I've done, and just convince them that the things that they are doing, the life that they are living, is something that readers would be intrigued by and see if that appeals to them at all. That's what appealed to Tony, the first person who I wrote about.
Tony, the owner of Bliss Bistro, a young man who worked his way up from what he said was selling large quantities of heroin, something you noted but said in a pure Times speech. It couldn't be independently verified. Surely you and your editors know you're going to be told a lot of things that aren't going to be independently verified.
Right. Well, in this case, that's not what the story was about. The story was about this place that I saw. The meat of the story is something that we were able to verify.
Various fine points of people's biographies are not crucial.
If I'm doing a profile, then I think it is crucial. But people who live life in such a way that there are no documents and other things like that, then we kind of have to take it at their word and have those disclaimers.
I think one thinks of the Times as a very hidebound institution. I mean, calling Meatloaf Mr. Loaf is the ultimate example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Very positive reaction to the brothel piece?
There were certainly people who wrote in to the public editor saying that it was beneath Time standards, but they were not the majority of people who responded. Most people enjoyed the story.
It did go through the standards editor, though.
Yes, yes. The standards editor is actually the person who suggested that we include that little disclaimer about Tony's biography.
Mm-hmm. So one down, the brothel piece. How is the beat going? Are you finding other things to write about?
I have a list of ideas, but I have had some trouble bringing the ideas to fruition. One reason is that people are much more hesitant than Tony was to tell their stories. They want to trade information in their stories either for money or some type of access or these kinds of things, which obviously as a reporter for the Times, I cannot do.
Could you give an example?
Yeah, I wanted to get into illegal poker rooms in the city, and I met someone who is a gambler and who also operates some of these rooms. And he said, yeah, I can help you get in there. You just have to pay me. You know, obviously I could not pay him, but he didn't get it. He thought that I was almost playing hard to get. So we didn't get anywhere.
I have to talk to you about the name of your beat, Sin. Merriam-Webster calls it an offense against religious or moral law. Then I looked in the Urban Dictionary, and it defines sin as good, dirty fun. So it's hard to define the beat if you don't define sin.
Even though we are not using sin as a religious term, we have loosely used the seven deadly sins as a guide to things that we should look into.
Like extreme plastic surgery?
Yeah.
Is that vanity?
That is on my list.
Hot dog eating contests?
Yeah.
Is that gluttony?
We consider that, but it's just been written about so much. But but yes, that could fall within my area of coverage.
And greed, one might argue, fuels one of the principal sources of income in the city of New York.
That's right. That one I probably will write about less only because there's been so much coverage of Wall Street guys who are greedy.
Sloth isn't very headline grabbing, is it?
No, that's actually a hard one. I don't know how I'm going to do anything on that. A lot of people have said, you know, I'm so envious of you. This sounds like an amazing assignment. And it is, but it's also pretty hard.
Do you think the Times may have created this beat, say, 40 years too late? Would it have been better in the 70s?
Yes.
Mosi, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mosi's Secret covers sin and vice for the New York Times.
While waiting for Mosi Secret's next story, you can always add some true crime to your summer reading list. You know, the glossy paperbacks full of crime, punishment, and ordinary people behaving badly that decorate the supermarket checkout aisle. But don't let those foil covers fool you, says Salon senior writer Laura Miller. Much true crime rises above mere pulp. And she should know, she's been a true crime aficionado since childhood. Helter Skelter, the book about the Manson killings, was Miller's first entree into the genre.
I first probably read Helter Skelter when I was babysitting, which is a very important vector of introduction to true crime for young women, is when you're babysitting and you look for the dirty books and the sugary snacks. But I probably the one that really just electrified me the most was on television. It was a docudrama with Robert Stack about the Black Dahlia killer. At the very end, he looks out at the audience from the television screen and he says, "You're out there. I know you're still out there," to the killer. And it just, oh, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. And that was when I was really hooked. It was the way that this outrageous thing that they were showing you on the screen, but they wouldn't show you all of it because it was too gruesome, was connected to the real world that I inhabited. You know, like maybe the Black Dahlia killer was not just out there, but right outside my window.
And yet there's kind of a stigma attached to true crime. And I guess it's not hard to figure out why, but why don't you tell me why?
Most true crime really is pretty trashy. I mean, it's voyeuristic, it's lurid. You know, that's an earned reputation. It's just that not all of the genre has those characteristics, and there are things that the genre can do that really no other genre can. And given how much of a factor crime is in all of the entertainment that we consume, Law and Order or detective fiction, which is pretty much the most popular form of genre fiction there is, you're just consuming a huge number of narratives that are not necessarily representative of what crime and justice and detection are like in real life.
I have read Helter Skelter about the Manson killings. I read The Onion Field and I read Fatal Vision. None of those are prominent on in my bookcases at this point. And yet In Cold Blood sits there right prominently.
Capote is a great stylist, so it's a high-class piece of work. Also, there's not a whole lot of mystery about the killing of the Clutter family, which is what Capote was writing about. But there is a mystery about why it came to be committed, because the people who committed it, they were monstrous without being entirely monsters. It's a book full of unanswered questions. I mean, that to me is what defines a great true crime book, is its willingness to accept the unanswerable about humanity and the impossibility of achieving justice.
If there's a definition of serious journalism, it's that the story matters. It has some significance to the reader beyond the lurid particulars. Is that the litmus test for differentiating good true crime from pulp?
I think that the right writer can make a particular crime matter when the wrong writer cannot. And a great example is Robert Kolker's recent book, Lost Girls, which is about some bodies of young women that have been found on Long Island, and no one is really sure if it's a serial killer situation. It's pretty ambiguous. Most of his book is the story of these young women and their lives and how they came to be in the situation where they were killed. Now, there's a New York Post way of telling that story, which is that they were all call girls who were working off of mostly Craigslist, and there's this scary monster, boogeyman-like figure out there. Or there's the question of how someone becomes a victim, told in a way that brings in the whole social context. So that becomes something more than just a freakish, scary occurrence that you kind of goggle at. And it instead looks at it as an inevitable symptom of some aspect of our society. The stories together move our frame of mind to a fuller grasp of reality.
In addition to your other duties for Salon, you write a book column every week.
Right.
You believe that we are in a golden age of true crime. How so?
Well, some of the great books that have come out just in the past couple of years have been Raymond Bonner's Anatomy of Injustice, which is the story of a wrongful murder conviction. There is a book that's just published by a group of people at the Columbia Law School called The Wrong Carlos, which is about another wrongful conviction that resulted in an execution in Texas. There's Errol Morris's A Wilderness of Error, which is a reconsideration of the Jeffrey McDonald conviction for the murder of his family.
Possibly one of the most written about true crimes.
Yeah.
Outside of the Kennedy assassination.
It was written about by Joe McGinnis, and then Joe McGinnis was written about by Janet Malcolm, and now the whole kit and caboodle has been written about by Errol Morris.
Now, we've discussed some classics.
Yeah.
What is the ultimate desert island classic in this genre?
Oh, God, what a question. You're supposed to say In Cold Blood, which is a really magnificent piece of work, but I think I would pick A Wilderness of Error. What it really brought home to me is the way that we think that we can look at the evidence and get a definite answer, but the more you look at it, the more you see, and the more you know, the less certain you become. And that, to me, is really the best message that the best true crime delivers.
Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Miller is a senior writer for Salon. Her piece on this subject is titled Sleazy, Bloody, and Surprisingly Smart in Defense of True Crime. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurakhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Rigler, and Mira Sharma. We had more help from Andrew Chug. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Leslie Sisson.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.